All right, we are here. Welcome to Wednesday, May 6th. Wednesday, May 6th. Chicago Music Revealed. Thanks for watching. Of course, everyone knows what's happening by now. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com. And this, of course, is Chicago Music Revealed, the only Monday through Friday daily talk show for music happening around anywhere. Well, I don't know. Maybe there is one or two, but none of them are as entertaining as this one. I can tell you that right now. So here's the deal. We've got a whole lot of stuff going on. We've got phase one through five that the governor just announced yesterday, which we're all sort of trying to sort through, especially all of us in the music industry, but also all of us in the realm of programming and entertainment, right? Because I'm also the program director and entertainment director at the Epiphany Center for the Arts. So I've been on the phone a lot with a lot of people today and yesterday, and nobody knows what's going on. So that's always good news. So, you know, welcome to city government. And so we're going to have to see what's happening. Hopefully everybody's staying safe. Everybody's staying healthy. Also, what else is in the news? As I mentioned yesterday, I know I have it written down, but I always look over here. As I mentioned yesterday, our friend Scott Stegman over at Winters, he started a GoFundMe page for the club to keep that open, to keep it up and happening. So if you can give, we've got a link on chicagomusicrevealed.com that you can click on. It'll take you over to all of the different GoFundMe pages for all of the staff, all of the venues, musicians. And then also the other thing with Scott is that he went through a little bit of health crisis here too, but he's coming out of that, it seems. But really the money that he can raise now is going to get him to reopen Winter. So that's an important thing. Also, want to shout out to Civil, which is the Chicago Independent Venue Organization, and they're doing a great job. I just got a press release from them the other day. We're going to have that up on Chicago Music Revealed, chicagojazz.com. Again, all of these different stipulations, nobody really knows what's happening. So that's the problem. Of course, the sooner we can get everything open, the better. So as soon as everybody stays home, stays away from everyone, and we can sort the entire COVID-19 situation out, hopefully somebody will be playing live again at some point very soon. Now, it is a special day today because I didn't even realize this, but our guest coming up, it's his birthday today, and that's not why we're having him on, but now apparently it is why we're having him on. Joel Spencer's on the phone. Joel, how are you?
All right, Mike. Thank you very much. Nice to be on today.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Thank you, buddy.
On top of everything else. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, well, first we're going to talk about Richie Cole because you had a lot of playing that you did with him back in the day. But, and then we're going to get into your career and also talk about U of I because you're, what's your official title at U of I? I always screw it up.
Assistant Professor of Music.
So you're down there. So I want to get your take on what's happening at U of I and how the end of your semester went, because I know you had to teach things online and do student projects and all of that stuff by Zoom, I would imagine. But before we get into everything like that, let's talk a little bit because we lost a legend on the Chicago scene for sure, but he's really an international treasure. Richie Cole, the great saxophonist, passed away just this past weekend, and you did a lot of playing with Richie, I think, back in the day, and you were in a group with him and Eddie Jefferson that just about to break out of Chicago. There's a famous video that maybe I'll play in a little bit with you guys performing on it, but talk a little bit about Richie Cole.
Well, that was what you were just speaking of, and playing with Richie and Eddie and out of Chicago, that was the very beginning of it. As a result, we'd also do some other work with Richie, but Richie was a very talented individual. He's a really nice guy and loved the music, loved jazz. I first heard about Richie before I had actually had a chance to play with him, coming up and like all young drummers, being a fan of Buddy Rich and hearing the Buddy Rich Band in 1970. There, as we heard, was an alto player that was 18 or 19 years old out of Berklee School of Music in Boston. And it was Richie Cole. Richie Cole was playing with the Buddy Rich Band, playing lead alto. That was a very big deal. So before I or our trio had a chance to play with Richie, we knew about Richie. I certainly did, playing with Buddy's band and being this exceptional player. So much so, here's a kid that's, you know, 18, 19 years old playing on a very demanding chair in a top band.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and so I think the first record Richie was on was a Buddy's recording called Buddy and Soul, and he was featured extensively on that record. So he had some really great things going right from the start. And basically the way we ended up, that is the John Campbell Trio, John, myself, and Kelly Sill playing with Richie and Eddie were, I believe it was a date they had in Springfield, and they needed a group. Mm-hmm. And someone hooked us up, you know, via Chicago connection, and we played with them, and the gig really went well. And the next thing, she worked out a deal. She thought, what a great thing. We'll bring our crew to the jazz showcase and record these players live. And it was just that quick, off the top of her head. They set up a very large crew, mm-hmm. and we hit. There were no second takes. It was all first takes. You see the film, it's us playing two sets. It's very fresh, but it worked so well. It was everybody just playing the way they do, hooking up, listening. And like I said, it was not rehearsed. It was not a rehearsed thing. And it came off almost in a flawless production. And Richie was a big part of it. Eddie Jefferson had been a very famous vocalist, but back in the 50s, an artist that dealt with scat. But what Eddie did, Eddie took someone's improvised solo, quote, a transcription, and he would sing it note for note and introducing his own lyrics. It was very bright. And he and the excitement at Richie Cole and the energy he could bring, the two of them worked out really well. As far as Richie and his playing, I'd say he was mostly influenced by Phil Woods. Yeah, that kind of sound and that kind of vibe.
Yeah. Well, talking a little bit about Eddie Jefferson, too. I mean, was that the beginnings, like what he was doing? Was that sort of the beginnings of the vocalese that like Kurt Elling and everybody came out of, obviously?
Well, yeah, he's probably one of the first people to be doing that of as far as I know. Not, of course, scatting was very much instilled in jazz, everything from Louis Armstrong to Ella Fitzgerald, Son and Sarah Vaughan, mm-hmm. great scat artists. We know that. But Eddie kind of went the next step further. He comes up in the hard bop era. You're talking about where he was in the mid and late 50s and taking famous solos as he would from Miles Davis and would set lyrics to their solos. He would sing you their exact solo and with lyrics that describe the player and the feeling and so on and so forth.
And it was like flawless too, because listening to this recording, and I'm going to play a lot. I tried to play it while you were talking, but then of course it muted and the screen froze, because you know, that's what this show does when we're going live.
Technology at its best. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's tough sometimes when you're playing that, mm-hmm. and it's streaming and everything, but anyways,
all right.
I'll play that in a second, but I mean, the stuff that he was doing, it really, he was like another instrument. Listening to that recording of you guys, I had Clark Summers on yesterday. He was talking about Kurt Elling. We were talking a little bit about how Kurt's voice and how he approaches vocalizing. It's like another instrument. Eddie, when you listen to this and he's doing the vocalese stuff, oh my God, is he smooth, man. It's just popping and the band's popping behind him. I could tell you guys were approaching his singing as if he's another instrument.
You bring up a very good point. That's exactly it. Yeah. When you play with Eddie, you felt like you were playing with a horn player, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You felt like you were playing truly with an instrumentalist. Now, while at the same time, as I said, he'd come up with an exact transcription, note for note solo, of course, he just scatted off the top of his head, and that's when he was a real horn player.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And the syllables were, quote, unintelligible. That is, it didn't deal with words, you know, lyrics, but just using percussive sounds and singing truly as a scat singer.
And then, so Richie was playing with Eddie Jefferson a little bit before you guys got involved.
Oh, right? Yeah, they were doing what a lot of named jazz players were doing at that time, to afford to play throughout the country, to do the national acts. You toured and you picked up those recommended rhythm sections. Mm-hmm. That's who we were in Chicago. But they were playing a lot of different festivals and playing in New York. They had a new record out and they were getting really great reviews from Downbeat and so on and so forth. And it had seemingly that perfect mix of the instrumentalist, the saxophonist, and yet the singer.
Mm-hmm.
And they just both really fit well. And Eddie, to see him, if you see the tape, you realize, and one thing that many people don't know, Eddie was, besides a singer, a professional dancer early in his career.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so when you watch this film of us playing, there are many moments Eddie lets loose and he's singing, he's scatting, or he's doing a transcribed solo. The next person plays a solo, and he might just start dancing in front of the band.
Well, back then, though, I mean, coming up in that era with Eddie, I mean, he was came out of that era of being an entertainer, not just like a jazz vocalist in front of the band. So, I mean, doing
exactly.
that kind of stuff, he was just on fire, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You knew that. I mean, his show was very so relaxed, but it was had, for lack of a better word at the moment, it had this precision. You knew he thought about it. He was very concerned, as all people in show business, of course, how well the audience can like what you're going to do. And he knew how to press those buttons.
Yeah.
So he was very smooth. He was great on the mic. He could be funny. He could tell you about how he learned a composition and who played it, who recorded it, how he heard someone live. So he would speak of his own experiences and talk about the history. And yet Richie Cole, of course, who was younger, had a lot of fire and a lot of energy. And he, instilled a fairly early age, had a lot of professional experience.
Yeah, he was. Own. He reminds me of, like, just from an age standpoint, Richie Cole, sort of comparable to, like, Chris Potter, right? I mean, at 19, 20, they had, like, some pretty heavy-duty gigs happening. Which
right,
they
some great players took note to them and believed, as Red Rodney did with Chris, heard Chris, and realized, this is an incredible talent. This is exactly who I'm looking for. And somebody who, by the way, you mentioned Chris Potter at 19, comes on Red's band and truly sounds like an adult developed jazz artist.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yes, that means.
And listening to, and you were on Red's band at the time. That's why I brought it up, because I know that you had that personal experience to that whole thing. Talk a little bit about Richie's playing, too. I mean, you've played with, hundreds and hundreds of different sax players, let's say. But, I know, and I've known you for a long time, and I know from a drummer too, maybe there's like 10 guys that you're like, okay, cool, this is going to be like a cut above, but it's different than everybody else I've played with. What was it about Richie's playing that kind of made him stand out on the scene and gave him that name recognition and made people nationally take notice?
That's a good question. What he had, he was very sharp at starting a solo and knowing how to build it and know what to play. He was very good at getting the audience inside what he was doing. And yet it wasn't like he was doing it in an unmusical way, but he was very quick to, I think, understand the audience, knew what was going down. As far as his own influence, very influenced by bop and post-bop players. So once again, somebody like a Phil Woods, Sonny Stitt, He had that. Richie had, by the way, that's also a great way to answer this question because it's so true. He had really sharp, developed technical skills on the alto.
Mm.
He was a very talented player and had the technical facility, and he used his technical facility to his advantage to create excitement and pull the audience in. And another thing I remember about his playing that I know at the time I noted, he didn't always play a long extended solo. Playing long solos had little to do with, I think, creating that excitement and the communication between the artist and the audience. So he seemed very mature at, he would not play a lot of solos and just go on and on in an attempt to be felt, to be heard as though he was a great player or to create attention. He could do that immediately, but he did it with his skills, which were really sharp.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's one of those things too. I mean, and now we can dial it back to, the U of I experience that you're doing and all of the teaching you've done and all of the different players that you've played with. And I tend to think that, I remember Art Davis telling me one time, because, you know, we were down at Andy's and I was sitting in and he was doing one of those double sessions on Mondays mm-hmm. that he used to do back in the late 90s. And, you know, he'd play for like 9 hours in a row with John Bainey and Charlie wow. Brohm and all those guys. Anyways, and he would play like two choruses and be done. And then somebody else would sit in and play like 40, you know, I don't know. And Art would be like, you know, man, you know, you got to really kind of whittle things down so you can say what you want to say in the most concise amount of time, because you shouldn't need 40 choruses to tell everybody what you're saying. Maybe two or three or four choruses, that should be sufficient. And when you hear the heavy duty players, especially when they're playing with a vocalist or something along those lines, you're right. They don't stretch out for 20 minutes. Usually they're telling a story, they're laying it down, and this is the way it is. Is that how you approach your teaching as well? I mean, I know that you teach drums, but you're also teaching music history. You're also teaching ensembles and combos and big bands and everything else. Is that one of the things that you relay to the students?
Yeah, I mean, dealing with the history of the music, introducing the players, their style traits, their influences, has everything to do about the whole circle of creating an improvised solo. And it's a message. It's communication. It's a language. It's a vocabulary. And trying to pull people inside of it that way and have them understand and look at somebody's playing, it's not a matter of how many notes or how fast they can play. That may, and certainly more than occasionally, show someone or demonstrate somebody's technical abilities, but it's the message. It's the clarity of the message.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the toughest thing too. I mean, that to me is the toughest thing. I mean, you can get all your chops and stuff together to be able to tell a story and be concise in your message. That's the stuff you practice for, right?
Right. I mean, it's when you hear somebody, it's hearing somebody, they're making a statement. It is a story. It's another form of communication. It is a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and of course, one of my favorite players in this music is Miles Davis. For that reason, there was this certain economy he certainly displayed, especially in his recordings in the mid and late 50s, in his work with Gil Evans, where I've always been amazed by how complete, how connected he is, and yet how wonderfully economical he is. And you know, another thing, to get back to Richie, mm-hmm. I don't want to forget this point. The way it worked, Richie, I could tell from the beginning, was done very well. He always made sure, or he seemed to be very much hooked into not overplaying or over or outdoing where Eddie was.
Mm.
That was another thing. Eddie was the focus, the focal point of the band, and for good reason, it obviously would be true.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
You know, I mean, I think that's one of the most important things I could say about Richie. Also knew, and all great players do, not to get in another person's way or to support or highlight their performance in the way you play.
Mm-hmm.
That's all very much a part of it.
So I know Eddie Jefferson, the story, it's a tragic story that happened actually the next day after this gig that you recorded. He was murdered, right? I mean, in Detroit.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and like shocking. Did you and Kelly and John get play again with Richie at some point? And
we did thereafter. We did play some gigs with Richie. As it turns out, after the showcase, they were to go to Detroit and to play Baker's Keyboard Lounge. It's a very famous jazz club in Detroit. We couldn't do it because we were booked on a weekend in Champaign, and it was highly advertised. And this club owner put some money into it. I mean, we just couldn't. And we told them, and they were fine.
Mm-hmm.
That was a point at which I am proud to say they were certainly giving great consideration to bringing us on the group and perhaps having a steady group with this trio. That could have been the makings. I can't say that for sure, but certainly there was certainly talk amongst us with them. And well, they went to Detroit, and then sad news is what has happened, and that was obviously it. And Richie would carry on, But those guys had this magic together, and this would, of course, so unfortunately happen while they were really like at an epic level as far as the group they were building and what they did together.
Yeah. I interviewed Richie. Geez, he was on one of my radio shows back in the day. He came down to the studio. Mm-hmm. Wonderful guy. And yes. He could tell stories and just really generous with his time and just generous, mm-hmm. you know, in general. I mean, you could tell. So I'm sure he was devastated from the situation that happened with Eddie. It probably set him back a little bit.
Yes.
And, you know, but he managed to come back. And I think I forget where he was living most recently, but I hadn't seen him playing around on the scene all that much. But I know that about 5, 6, 7 years ago, he's still doing recordings and things. So, I mean, he was still creating, I believe, all the way up until, this past weekend, which I...
He's obviously and always a dedicated musician and worked throughout the country. We worked some gigs at Elkhart Jazz Festival with Richie.
Mm-hmm.
I think one year we did a side stage Chicago Jazz Fest with Richie.
Yeah.
So we would meet up with him at various intervals. But, of course, it was never the same as it was with the team of Eddie Jefferson and Richie Gold.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about U of I now. Okay. So you're down at U of I. You're finishing up the semester. And by the way, before we even get into the COVID-19 discussion here about finishing the semester, I mean, the U of I jazz program is, I think, really in the past 5, 6, 7 years has really grown into its own to be one of the, you know, leading jazz programs throughout the country. I mean, who's down there? Who's on faculty? I mean, I know you've been there How long have you been there now? Is it 15 years?
No, not quite that much. It's been 8 years.
Oh, okay.
And it's a wonderful faculty and a faculty that came up as professional players and certainly made a living and a name for themselves in a large city before taking on the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Our saxophone instructors are Chip McNeil and Ron Bridgewater. Ron, brother of Cecil Bridgewater, has been there for probably the past 25 years or so. And Ron is an incredible player and came up playing with the Thad Jones Mel Lewis band when he moved to New York in the 70s.
Wow.
He's on a number of those records. Jim Pugh, our trombone instructor, is great, plays with Steely Dan in the off season. He's been doing that gig for about 15 years or so. He's incredible. Joan Hickey teaches piano. Joan has been there for over 20 years in her position, doing an incredible job. Tito Carrillo is our trumpet instructor. And Tito, of course, everybody in Chicago knows Tito. Tito has been there for some time. Great. Larry Gray is our bass instructor, incredible teacher, incredible player. He's been there for, I don't know, 10 or 12 years, as long as Tito has been. And then there's Chip Stevens, the pianist. And Chip Stevens, we have two Chips. We have Chip Stevens, pianist, Chip McNeil on tenor. Both of them have played with Arturo Sandoval, mm-hmm. Woody's band, Woody Herman band, Maynard Ferguson. So it's one thing, and I think the kids get a feel for it. We have a teaching faculty that has been in the music business and actually developed their skills to succeed in that business, and I think that's what our students are looking for as well. So there's that connection. And the program, it is a jazz performance program, and that is the mark. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the program is complete with many different phases of study, as you would imagine, in theory, composition, history, so on and so forth, improv levels of different improvisational methods. But playing and the performance has everything to do with it. And of course, right now, we've been about 7 weeks now, and in fact, class is finished this afternoon. Today was our last day of scheduled classes, but this past 7 weeks were without the groups, without the performances, without combo and large ensemble.
Are you doing lessons like Zoom lessons to finish out the semester? I mean, because you're teaching right? Is that?
Mm-hmm. For now, the last 7 weeks, it's Zoom online education for my history courses, for jazz listening, and for private applied lessons, yes.
How does that, because I've never taken a Zoom lesson. I've never given a Zoom lesson because I don't teach anymore. But, I mean, how is that interaction especially like with drums, or I could see maybe saxophone, but I mean, with drums, I mean, you have so many things going on, the hi-hat, bass drum, ride cymbal, snare, all that stuff. Does it come through clear? Can you really get a feel for what is happening?
That's a good question, because it's on Zoom, and we learned this when we were all preparing during our spring break and ready to come back and go online, go to Zoom. There's different settings that are specific to curtailing difficult sounds. Drums might be one of the most difficult,
yeah.
But you go into Zoom into settings and you can generate, you can set the sounds up in a different way. But the communication is good. Once, you know, it's that everybody has to have a certain sense, a certain level of gear to perpetuate, you know, a quality sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of students that did it well on a macro Windows going into Zoom and dealing with it. And it's, in many ways, it surprised me, it exceeded my expectations. But after doing it, and I mean, I think everybody did an incredible job and prepared well in just a short week. Of course, having the students live there in the room and teaching in person, of course, is so greatly preferred. And we look forward to returning back to normal.
Yeah, no kidding, right? No kidding. No.
Yeah,
you know,
sooner than later.
I should bring up, too, because, you know, I went to North Texas. I came back. I studied with Joel for 4 years, actually. After I was at North Texas, I came back. And the one thing that I'll say, because there's a lot of students watch this, a lot of younger students, a lot of, you know, parents that have students that are thinking about going somewhere to college. I think it's an essential element to study with somebody that's done it, like performed, not just taught, but actually performed. Because I can remember our lessons. I mean, I'd come in, I could play, and we would go through stuff, but I was sitting in, I was playing every single night, I was out and about. So when I came in, I had specific questions that we would go over, in addition to like the curriculum stuff we were running through to make sure mm-hmm. I could keep my crap together. And I can say that on my show because it's my show. But the other thing is I can remember specifically, like, we'd have long conversations sometimes about business. And that's something that, unless you're in the business, you can't talk specifically about the business. And that's why it's so important to be studying with someone, especially when you get to a level where you're preparing yourself to go into a career. So you got to study with somebody that, you know, you and I had long talks about contracting, about what to charge, about how to work a contract, a band, how to worry about a recording, how to do this, how to do that, because you had like 28 recordings. You had 28 spots running, I think, nationally at that time. That's when the jingle business was still kind of winding down. You were still at the Gold Star, actually. It was like the last 6 months of you being at the Gold Star, I think, is when I started studying with you. So, you know, you had a lot of stuff going on at that point, and it was ideal. And I think that a lot of people need to take that into account when they're deciding on where they want to go to school, who they want to study with, when they're deciding this is going to be their profession.
Right. You need to work with somebody who's been in the business and has a feeling for it, and yet study with someone who's really going to work on your playing specifically. Mm-hmm. And also to realize, and I think with great teachers, students realize the most important thing is developing who you are. The reason people are going to call you, the reason you can succeed, it's because what you have to offer as an individual. In fact, that's the most effective competitive tool that you have, being yourself and sounding like you. That is, you're not sounding like someone else. You're right. Trying to develop your own voice. And so I think it's something we certainly preach at school, and we try to develop the individual player.
Mm-hmm.
And yet with a curriculum that deals with many segments, many phases of learning and developing. And no, it's good. Thanks for the compliment to our school. We're you know, we have a faculty that's very serious and hardworking. Yes.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I wanted to make sure I said that, because I know a lot of people sit there and they look at, if they're really looking at stuff, they're looking at Berkeley, they're looking at Miami, they're looking at Indiana, they're looking mm-hmm. at, you know,
yeah.
North Texas, things like that. But U of I is now getting into the mix because of the quality and the players that are actually teaching down there. And it's important. I mean, you know, I can still remember, though. I mean, there's some good stories, too. I mean, you know, you and I would be down there. You'd always put me at the last lesson, because I had a lesson every 2 weeks. And I remember your wife, Joan Hickey, by the way, she would say hi to me, and then like 3 hours later, she'd be like, "You're still here? What are you doing?" Because you know, we're talking about stuff, and we're talking about all this stuff, and the time just mm-hmm. flies by, and it is what it is.
Yeah,
that,
it does.
That's the kind of thing that's important, you know. So mm-hmm. what do you have coming up here? I know there's nothing absolutely coming up, but the plan is to go back to school in the fall, right?
Right. We're, you know, school. Hopefully, we're going to be back in the fall. Hopefully, you know, places will reopen and all those great gigs will come back. I, like everyone else, the same story. Great gigs that were on the calendar. I'm sure concerts and events that were in planning stages. We're taking off the books. That's mm-hmm. my experience. So right now, I can't specifically talk about, you know, gigs that were coming up at the Green Mill or possible jazz festival dates or, you know, working with Dan Trudell.
Oh, that's right. You were doing the Lake Geneva thing. That's right. With Dan. That's right.
Right. Dan sounding great playing jazz trio. I was a ton of fun, really missing that. But, so right now, not working as far as playing any gigs, of course not.
Well, by the way, just so everybody knows, if you want a good follow on Facebook, follow Dan Trudell, because he was fishing. He had like a fake fishing pole, and he was fishing in his backyard the other day. And social distancing, he's quite a character. He's like, it was very interesting. So, but he's
somehow
a great
that
player.
Doesn't surprise me.
No. Oh my God. Well, hopefully now that they've at least lifted the ban on golfing, you and I will get out and play some golf and be able to do something like that. And
that's a possibility,
you know, and hopefully, you know, like you said, we'll be back to normal. We'll be playing, we'll be doing something, you know, in the music industry sometime sooner rather than later. By the way, I should also mention, go to ChicagoJazzMagazine.com because a couple of months ago, and everything's run together and I'm all off kilter because I forget which one it was. I believe it was the December issue, 2019. You were the feature interview. So there's a long feature interview with Joel still up there on Chicago Jazz Magazine. We cover a whole lot, his whole life, his whole starting off as a young player back when he was like 15 and 16, playing seven nights a week all the way up until now. So it's a wonderful interview. I encourage everybody to go check that out. And, you know, Joel, thanks for jumping on. I appreciate you remembering Richie Cole because – you know, I knew he passed and I wanted to do something, and I wanted to do something more than just write a short something up on Chicago Jazz Magazine. So it's always good to have those personal stories like what you told, because that means more, I think, for his legacy than just, you know, it's just putting something up online.
No, thanks so much for having me on. And yeah, Richie will be missed. He was someone right from the heart, was very serious about playing and loved the music and loved to play.
Yeah.
So Richie was a very dedicated student of the music and a very dedicated performer.
Yeah. All right. Well, have a good, what is it, Thursday? Have a good birthday, May 6th. Big party over at Joel's house tonight, right? With one person,
That's
hopefully.
That's it, man. Look out. Hey, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on. You take care.
All right. Thanks, Joel. Talk to you.
Okay. See you.
Joel Spencer, you know, I'm glad I had him on because he could talk. I knew he could talk, you know, personally about Richie, and he played with Richie. And I'm going to play a video, and I waited till Joel got off the phone. I tried to play it. I tried to be slick with my technology, and it didn't work. It froze up the thing trying to have him talk over the video. I'm supposed to be able to do that in this system, but it didn't allow me. But that's all right. As I always say, I'm running the board myself. I'm running the cameras. I'm doing everything here myself. So it's completely my fault. I can take ownership of it. So what we're going to do right now, I'm going to see if we can actually get this to play. So let's stand by. I'm going to close the show after it. So if it freezes up, you're not going to miss much. Tomorrow we've got Shonda Brooks on. We are going to be talking all about Windy Fest, about all of her different organizations that she runs. She worked for DCase for a while. She started a couple of different organizations specific to help artists and musicians get the word out and showcase their music and their art in Chicago. Wonderful person. I met her. She's going to come into Epiphany Center for the Arts, and we're going to do a Windy Fest over there, which is the third annual. So we're going to talk to Shonda tomorrow. And then on Friday, we've got Blues in Chicago with Dave Katzman. He's coming. He's going to do his hit on Friday. And then we're going to have legendary blues man John Primer on, and we're going to be talking all about his career and recordings and all the good stuff. And we're planning, we might be, it's top secret right now, but we're planning some stuff for the Epiphany Center for the Arts with John Primer this fall, which is going to be very cool. I don't think we're going to talk about it tomorrow, but I'm teasing it out there just in case we do. So, all right, I'm going to try to play this tune. This is just a very short 20-second clip, but you can get an idea. Eddie Jefferson playing with Richie Cole, 1979, at the Chicago Jazz Showcase on Rush Street, with John Campbell piano, Joel Spencer, who you just heard, on drums, and Kelly Sill on bass. Let's see if I can make this happen, and I will be back right after this short clip. And I'm so last time I saw Janine. All right, hopefully that played smoothly. Hopefully everybody could get a feel for what that is. If you go up on YouTube and you do a search, Eddie Jefferson, Richie Cole, it's a 52-minute concert on YouTube. You can also buy it as well. I know it's for purchase through YouTube, through the link in the bottom from the distributor. So big thank you to Joel Spencer for jumping on today. I am glad that we got to talk a little bit about Richie Cole, and I'm glad we learned a little bit about the University of Illinois Jazz Program. It's a killer jazz program. I know all the musicians down there. It's probably one of the best ones, I would say, in the country. So be sure to keep an eye out. So when we're back doing something in person, they are going to do some concerts up here in Chicago. And we should be able to see them live and in person. So, looks like Tracy Oliver said it worked. So I'm going to go with Tracy. Thank you. All right. Sue Strauss says it works as well. So I love it. All right. Good. See? Technology is good. And now I know how I have to do that. I can't talk over video. I got to play it separately. So, all right, good. So I'm glad everybody got a taste of that. I love the feedback. I love the comments. I love the questions. I love the likes. So if you like the show, please like it up. This is episode 28. We will be back tomorrow. And as I always say, and I'm gonna get this going, as I always say, please be sure to share this with everybody that you know. Please tell your neighbors, tell your family, call the grandkids. Chicago Music Revealed, every day, Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. right here on Chicago Music Revealed on Facebook. ChicagoMusicRevealed.com, all the past episodes. And until next time, I will see you tomorrow on the next broadcast. Stay safe.